Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Noah Baumbach's new film is Marriage Story. It's stunning. When I first saw the film, I could barely find the words to express my reaction. It felt that real, that honest. Baumbach is known for messy and realistic family dramas. The Squid and the Whale chronicles divorce. Margot at the Wedding explores the relationship between two sisters. The Meyerowitz stories tells of three adult siblings, different mothers, same father, negotiating resentment and love. But Marriage Story puts Baumbach on a plane with Woody Allen, Barry Levinson, and Mike Nichols in terms of directing talent. The writing, directing, and acting come together perfectly. Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson inhabit Baumbach's words with exquisite performances of a couple coming apart while parenting a young son. There have been plenty of comparisons between Baumbach's own life and his movies, especially so with Marriage Story. Baumbach and actress Jennifer Jason Leigh divorced soon after they had a child. But Baumbach is quick to say his films are not autobiographical, they are personal. He admits that the process of turning real life into films is part of how he copes and makes sense of things.
When hard things have happened to me in my life, and I mean not only hard things, but certainly hard things have happened in my life, there is a kind of comfort, I think, in my mind of sort of what would this be if we put it in a movie. I think something Did you know Mike Nichols much? I mean, yeah, you work with him, but I worked
with him and kept in touch with him.
You're so good in Working Girl, though.
Yeah, well, thank you.
He said when I met him after Squid and the Whale, and he said it reminded me of why I got into the movie business in the first place, which is revenge. And I thought, I know what he means, though, because, again, it's not revenge on a person. It's almost like revenge on experience, or and from that, with that movie, it was kind of childhood. It was like a way for me to stand up for my younger self as an adult now, who had a voice that child didn't have. And I think I do think of that sometimes in my life, not necessarily while I'm going through it, but sort of maybe soon after, of that there's a kind of soothing way of like, what would that be, whether or not it ever becomes a scene in a movie or not. I've definitely had that in like hospital situations where. The movie I made before, the Meyerowitz stories, my father had been in the hospital for a long time and I...
You were close to your dad?
I was, yeah. And I mean, if I imagine you've spent some time in hospitals, it's sort of, you know, it's such a, not unlike the divorce system. It's like the ways you learn to function only work in that environment. They don't have any practical application outside of that environment, you know, like how you work with a nurse or a doctor and then the changing nurse and then that doctor's going on vacation. And I didn't make a movie about it for many years later, but I felt like, well, that was a certain kind of reappropriating that situation and turning it into something else.
One of the things, among many things I'm reminded of when I saw your film, because I wrote a book about my divorce, not necessarily because I changed a lot of details and I assigned a lot of stories and ideas to fictitious characters that I made up in fictional oral histories because I didn't want to say too much about specific people. But if your films are personal but not autobiographical, I'm assuming that when you do these films, like Squid and the Whale and Marriage Story, there's a lot you leave out. Is that a process for you of what stays in and what doesn't go in?
Yeah, it is. And with Marriage Story, a lot of it was what I discovered in writing it, or once I had a draft of it, was that it worked best when I stayed on the process and the story of the divorce itself, because all the life stuff, as in your book, you write about this wonderfully too, is that the life stuff doesn't stop for you to get divorced, even though the divorce takes over your life and kind of.
You got to go to work.
Yeah, you have to go to work. You still have to be a parent, and you have to be a parent even if it's difficult to be with your kid. You're now with your kid, and you're distracted by the divorce. And so I felt like I just have to acknowledge that and tell that story, and all of those life moments will be there because that is the movie too. And it was these other scenes that were more sort of maybe set piece scenes that were kind of just taking, and they were just other things. They were, and so I, that was the stuff I really stripped away in the script stage for Marriage Story.
You wrote it yourself, the screenplay?
Yeah.
Completely?
Yeah.
When you write something, do you have people who counsel you that you respect and you hand them drafts and you get notes from them and
yeah.
ideas from them?
Many, yeah. I show Greta Gerwig, who I live with, everything. And she also is a sounding board even early on when I'm...
You're married. You two got married.
We're not technically married, but we have a child.
Right.
And yes, so we...
Right. So you have your current love of your life and your child. She's the sounding board for the movie about your divorce from your... No, I'm kidding.
Well, but just anything, we'll say. Any right. any ideas.
Across the board.
Across the board. And I have friends, director friends, writer friends who I might... certainly that I'll show early drafts to. I bring my editor, Jen Lame, in always from early drafts because my idea is that we should almost cut the script the way we're going to cut the final movie. So I involve
her.
Not
a lot of fat.
Yeah. So like let's shoot what we think we're really going to use. And
why do you think you do that as opposed to, I mean, some people don't do that. Most don't do that.
Well, I feel like for me, time is so important. I mean, it's important for every director, I imagine, but I want to have time with these scenes and time for the actors and be able, I like to do a lot of takes and I want to be able to explore, not totally unlike you might in a play or something, you know, be able to, you know, get as much out of these scenes as we can get and not feel like, oh, I wish we'd
had another. You want to luxuriate in what you know and your heart really matters as opposed to stuff that you're not so sure.
Yeah. And I find also when I'm working with actors who I love, who really, when it's really clicking, they're always giving me ideas while we're doing it. A lot of my direction comes from things they do in a scene that gives me an idea of how we could push the scene in that direction. So I don't want to shoot scenes or things that I'm not going to use if I can avoid it. I mean, there's always stuff you cut, but if I can get the script as close to what I think the movie is going to be, I feel like all the better.
I mean, the movie's an amazing movie. It's an amazing movie.
Thank you.
And you don't, you know, you're an enormously talented director. You're an enormously talented writer. And you also happen to get the two actors that would be, in my mind, everyone's dream to do a drama like that. I mean, he's at the top of his game. Everybody thinks he's one of the five most talented men alive today. And her, the same thing. She's almost on another planet in terms of her range and things she's done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, what's the path to them with you? Is it a formal process through representation, or is it like you're having dinner with Barry Levinson and he says, I can call Adam? You know, is it?
Well, this is my fourth movie with Adam. So I've, because
right.
I
you knew Adam.
I knew Adam. I cast Adam in Frances Ha off an audition, and it was before Girls had come out. So I hadn't seen him in anything. He just came in, and so I've had a relationship with him since then. And, So it for us, and we've become friends.
And what was it about him that's, if you can...
Well, Adam described acting as benign rebellion once. We were doing an interview together, and he said it, and I just, it was one of those things where you're doing press, and you're all saying the same things over and over, and then he suddenly said this. I hadn't heard this before, and I thought, what an interesting, great way to describe what an actor does, and also very much what he does, which I do find he's both in serving the material, the movie, the story always, but he's always looking for true moments, spontaneous things that activate him. And so he is pushing constantly. And so he'll say things to me like, I think I'm not going to cross my legs in this take. And I know he has a reason, because it's going to change something for him that might have great ripple effects for the scene. I may not even know why, or hadn't even thought about the fact that he was crossing his legs. I was maybe thinking or watching something else. And that's he's very aware and unaware at the same time. It's that conscious, unconscious thing that actors do. And it's my favorite way to work. He loves rehearsing. He loves doing many takes. He knows every bit of dialogue down to the ellipse, and he's thought about it, and he has the hesitation as it's scripted. He has found his way into it. I mean, it really is that thing. Forget who said this, but someone said about poetry that it gives you your own thoughts back with added majesty. And I find he gives me back my words and my...
You'll have to make every film with him now.
Yeah, I know. Well, I would like to. I mean, he's really special. He's also... he's like this. He can talk. We talk about movies in general. It's not all about just his performance. Or he's always very interested in what the story's going to be, what the movie as a whole. It's not just about, you know, he's a real collaborator in the bigger sense, too.
I love that. But what's it like to approach someone? You've known him for a while now, and you are friends with him. To approach him as things with him are at the boiling point now in terms of his career. Is it hard to get him to, do you have the kind of relationship where he turns to the rest of the world and says, shh, I'm talking to Noah on the phone, and he goes in your direction? Or
yeah,
is it tough to find a window in his schedule?
Well, things have to be planned now.
He's busy.
More carefully, but he will make the time because it's something he feels strongly about.
He wants to do your thing, yeah. Now, what about her? How did you approach her?
She, I'd known a little bit just over the years. We'd almost done a thing together probably about 10 years ago or something. So I'd always sort of felt like, oh, at some point I'll have something I feel is right for her. And Adam and I talked about it. This was even before the script was really written. We talked about, well, who would be the right person, you know, for this movie? And she was both of our first idea. So I reached out to her. I just emailed her and said, I think maybe I have something we could do together. And we met for lunch, and then she arrived and said, sorry, I'm late. I was on the phone with my lawyer. I'm going through a divorce. And I thought, oh, Jesus. And
wow.
So I thought, well, then this is either going to be great or terrible.
Disaster.
yeah, disaster. To her credit, it was great. She went in that direction. She just saw it as a way to, you know, to take it on.
Yeah. Her career is so varied.
Yeah.
I mean, she can convey innocence and a sweetness and a vulnerability and a kind of when she did Under the Skin, kind of a deadness,
right?
Kind of an emotional neutrality that's like a she's from another planet. You know, there's an essence to her that she can manipulate,
mm-hmm.
And on screen, she's one of the few actresses I know that comes across a completely different people when she performs.
Yeah, well, there's a thing scripted, the thing that was in the script, which I wrote thinking about her, because she's an actor. In the beginning, it's the closing night of their theater company and their home, and things are tense, and he can't help but give her a note even though she's never going to play this part again, he's going to give her a note on the final performance. And she says that she has trouble crying on stage, you know, that what follows is she turns and is sobbing in life, in the movie In Life. And I felt she could both convey the sort of that moment of that sort of defensive moment of and then turn and just completely open up, you know, within it's you know, it is literally in a turn. She turns and starts crying. And that's, you know, something having her in mind while I'm writing gives you the idea for something like that.
You grew up in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
And your parents got divorced when you were how old?
I was 14 when my father finally moved out.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was a writer. He was a teacher at Brooklyn College. And
what did he teach?
He ran the creative writing program, for a PhD program at Brooklyn College. And then he also was a writer, a novelist and short story writer, but also did film criticism. He was sort of that era where you kind of did all, the, you know, like there was that kind of intellectual life where you did many things. There was less.
And your mom was a film critic as well?
My mom became a film critic. She was a film critic, I should, but became, for me, it was later in my life. It was when I was, really when I went to college. She also had written fiction and had some stories in The New Yorker and had also taught. And I mean, the way my brother and I always described it is that art in our family was kind of like religion. It was the highest.
On.
Yeah, and the highest sort of thing to aim for.
Now, when you were growing up, because I ask practically everyone who works in film and television and beyond, you know, or if they're in music, I ask them regarding their early years in terms of music appreciation. What was film and television in your childhood? What was that like?
Film was a big... My parents really loved movies, so they took me to a lot of movies.
Yeah. You went to go see Sorrow and the Pity when you were 8 years
well,
old.
Well, kind of. But they also were into what I was into also. My father particularly made a real effort to go to, I was born in 69, so it was sort of the early 80s is when I was started like really kind of branching out in terms of movies. And he would go with me really to anything. I mean, we would just go to movies.
Right.
And
I like that.
Yeah. And we'd see.
What does it matter?
Yeah.
And if it sucks, then we learned that.
Yeah, we learned that. And we would have, you know, I remember seeing all these Richard, because, you know, I love Richard Pryor, and we'd go to all these just terrible Richard Pryor movies. And that he was clearly doing for a paycheck.
Silver Streak.
Yeah. Well, Silver Streak was a pretty good one.
Oh, a good one.
but I remember there was one called Some Kind of Hero with Margot Kidder, which is, I remember we were both so baffled, we couldn't believe how bad it was, and but that was kind of almost as good as an
what
experience.
What else are we going to do?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just going and sitting and
your religion.
It was in a sense, and he was of the mind that we don't spend the extra money on the concessions. So it really was just the movie. We.
Where did he grow up? Where was he from?
He's from Brooklyn too. From Brooklyn. He his father was a painter and. He grew up in Brooklyn. He went to Brooklyn College. He went to New Utrecht High School, and then he went to Brooklyn College.
A painter, like the painting hanging on the wall, or the wall itself you paint?
Like the one hanging on the wall, artist.
He's an artist.
Yeah.
And your mother, where was she
My
from?
Mother was from, her whole family's from the South. Her name's Georgia Brown. She was named after Georgia, the place. And her father worked for Coca-Cola, so they traveled a lot. And when I was... older, her parents were living in Seattle, but they had all started in the South.
Did you know? I mean, I'm from things I've read, I'm under the impression you knew pretty early on where you were headed.
I wanted it. I wanted to make movies very badly, but I wasn't around anybody who made them. So I had no, even though my parents were so into movies, our experience of movies was kind of like living in Brooklyn. We felt both sort of around where things were happening, but never. It was never actually happening to us.
Right.
It was that feeling, always a feeling outside. And I think my father felt that quite a bit. He felt outside. He felt unrecognized as a writer, a novelist. And there was always this feeling of like, it's not happening here. It's over there.
You went to Vassar.
I went to Vassar.
And what did you study film?
They didn't really have much of a film program then. I mean, they had a film studies program. I'd watch movies. But I was an English major.
When you finished at Vassar, what did you do?
I wrote a script, but I'd never actually seen a script before. I printed out. I'd seen them published, but I didn't realize those were often just transcripts they would retype from the movie itself. And it was before any kind of final draft or any formatting program. So I was just I got so hung up. I'm pretty anal about these things. So I was trying to get all the tabs right on my typewriter and then on my computer, you know. And so I was just...
So you're writing a page a month.
Yes. My whole experience is tabs and trying to center everything and get the...
Before they had those the screenwriting program.
It was awful. And then you'd print it and realize one was off. And I wrote what became my first movie called Kicking and Screaming.
How old were you?
Well, I guess I started writing it, I guess, when I was 22, 23.
Where were you living?
Well, after college, I was a messenger at The New Yorker, which was my summer job. And then after I got out of college, I guess it was potentially my job. But then I moved to Chicago because I had a lot of friends who were doing improv and theater in Chicago, and I wanted to kind of just be around them. And
you needed some laughs.
I needed some laughs, yeah.
I moved to Chicago.
I did improv a bit, too. I liked it. It wasn't that different from writing, in a way. It was...
How long were you there?
I was there not that long, under a year. But I was writing this script, and then I came back to New York and set out trying to make it. I had two friends from college, Jeremy Kramer and Jason Blum.
The Jason Blum.
Yes. And we had all lived together in college. Jason and I lived together in Chicago. And then we all sort of, I said, well, why don't you produce this and let's try to make it.
What was the budget?
Well, we didn't even know what
what the budget. We still don't know.
We still don't know. But
still not in profit.
It ended up getting made for $1 million, which was way more than I thought it would. But it was made in a way that was unexpected, and after it had fallen through many, many times by this company Trimark, which was a video company who wanted maybe to get into sort of a Miramax kind of business.
They wanted content.
Yeah, and they made it for $1 million, which again I felt like
it's a lot of money for your first movie.
Yeah, in a way it was too much. It was now I always think about this now, and I've heard Jason say this too. I think now we would have just made it, because you could with cameras now. The digital's right. Cameras hadn't
film.
Really yeah and you, I did cut on film. That was I had on Kicking and Screaming was the I had the whole experience of cutting on film and all pre-digital. It was just as it turned.
I just worked with a bunch of people, you know, my production company where I was, and it's a generation of filmmakers who really don't know anything else. They do it because they just don't know anything else. And they shot this film for, I can't remember, maybe it was 12 days, 2 6-day weeks. And they shoot the film for $175,000. And he just got into Sundance.
That's great.
You know, but it's like you see the way the movie business now is anything goes. You know, if you just get it up there.
Well, there is more opportunity now because of that you can do. I mean, I made Francis Ha digitally with a crew of about 7 people because I felt like, in a sense, it was like making a first movie I never made. But I thought also, why don't I do it now with everything I know and that I've learned, and use the fact that we're kind of under the radar as there would be certain limitations, but there would be freedoms. Well, what I did is I shot for 60 days because it was so much less to shoot. It's like the film version of if you dig down, you'll into the earth, you'll end up in China. Right. You know, it was we'll actually have more freedom in certain ways, because nobody knows we're doing this, and we're so small. And and we shot on consumer digital camera. We shot on the 5D. It was black and white, and it was great. I mean, and my feeling was, I'm not going to do this to make it like a B-side. I'm going to do this because I think this is the best thing for this movie and will be the best version of this movie.
Noah Baumbach co-wrote Francis Ha with his partner, Greta Gerwig. She also starred in the movie. Baumbach is known for wanting a lot of takes from his actors. To hear from one of those actors, take a listen to my conversation with Jeff Daniels.
I gotta create.
You can't have a regular job.
I can't. Once you start to understand you're creating a character in a musical in a community theater or college or whatever, and boom, boom, you start to go down that road. It's like the sharks. You got to keep moving.
My full conversation with Jeff Daniels is at heresthething.org. He starred in Bombeck's The Squid and the Whale. More on that film coming up.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Promoting Marriage Story, Noah Baumbach has been deflecting questions about his own personal life. When The Squid and the Whale came out, a story about a Brooklyn family and what happens when the parents divorce, Baumbach had to deal with the reaction of his own parents.
They knew it was coming. I mean, it was, again, because it was different. It wasn't our situation.
Sure.
But there were...
There were a few teaspoons of it in there.
The milieu was familiar. And... they were good sports about it. I mean, they, I think one thing that was hard for them, which I didn't anticipate, and I was that people would assume then that things that were in the movie were true and talk to them about it as if they were true things.
Right.
So I guess I hadn't thought of it that way, that, oh, well, this will all be perceived as true in their lives from other people. So that could be a drag, I'm sure.
Their friends over dinner are like...
yeah, like, oh, we didn't know that was going on in the house. And it's like, well, it wasn't really, or that I didn't... I guess I didn't anticipate when I was working on it.
Now, let me say, you know, your ex is one of my favorite actresses. I had, like, she's one of my top three favorite
actresses. She's fantastic, yeah.
I had one of the greatest experiences of my life. I've always said that. Working with her, she was just so free and inventive.
Miami Blues.
Yeah. I do that movie with her, and I learned from her, which I thought to myself, I wasn't prepared for that when I was working back then. But what are the pitfalls for your roommate, wife, what have you, your loved one, being an actress and you're a director? What would you warn other directors about that?
Well, I mean, in both Jennifer and Greta, they're both wonderful actors, and they're both filmmakers. I mean, when I met Jennifer, she just made The Anniversary Party. She directed with Alan Cumming, which is a really great movie. They both have a kind of incredible ability of being very present, as you're saying, like free and present as actors. But also they're storytellers, I guess, in that way, you know, and Greta's an amazing director and writer. And so I guess I never thought of it so much as like director, actor in that, in the
yeah,
way.
No, I always wonder. I always think of it in terms of, you know, how great to be, if you're going to be with an actress, it's great to be with, and you can't always pick them this way, one who's very talented.
Yeah.
I found that, but an increasing number of people, they realized, not that this was either good or bad, it just occurred, was they discovered they liked directing more than acting.
Right.
And the acting started to get less and less and less. Because to find material, to access material that is worthwhile. You know, Dustin Hoffman said to me in a meeting once a million years ago, he said to me, Alec, we're all in line. Some of us are just in a shorter line to get that good script and that good material.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think in both cases, they both have written things that they've acted in to give themselves that opportunity. It's actually, as you were saying that, I realized you've acted with both of them.
Well, yeah, we did Woody's movie.
Yeah.
We did Woody's movie. But I remember I love doing them. I love Woody and I love working with him. And it was always like, and what a treat to work with younger actors who I'm always so keen on. But while I still have you, I want to ask you. So, you know, in my life, I have worked with great directors, sometimes very small roles, and you come in and they know very well what your function in the piece is. They know the whole panoply of the whole thing. And I'm not somebody who's ever been a big enough movie star in the old school way to walk in and go, we need to fire Bob. You just get rid of the director.
Right.
But my point is when I'm sitting down with you in the earliest stages, do you think that that's job one for you, is to help that person to understand what you want?
Yeah, I think, well, I'm often interested in how the actor first comes at it without me saying anything. I mean, because I think a lot of it is in the rhythm of the lines and it's
very dialogue driven,
musicality of the lines. And I think that helps the actor find it. I find usually when actors are having trouble with a scene, it's because they have the line wrong, or they've dropped a line, or they've inverted words. It falls flat. And I'll even sometimes forget what the real line is and be trying to figure it out. And then I'll look at the script and I'll realize, oh, it's...
He inverted.
You're doing... And I find it helps them and me then to kind of hear the scene properly. There's a lot of blocking and physical stuff that I also find can help. I mean, it's like what Elia Kazan would say, he was a prop director, you know, that he, they'd ask him, you know, about how he directed. And he said, I just come up with a lot of good props. And then the actors, I find that takes care of a lot for the actors. But unless it's absolutely wrong for the story, I want the actor to suggest in what they're doing, suggests life beyond this scene, so that there's in a different movie, in the Altman version or whatever, we might go with that person, and that wouldn't be so surprising.
We'll go with him to the parking lot, yes, when he gets in the car.
Yeah, because, and you know, particularly if you have, you know, really interesting actor doing a smaller role, you want all that stuff, you know. And I mean, it's not right for, say, the evaluator who comes and watches in Marriage Story, if the woman who comes to see, observe Charlie and Henry have dinner in his apartment. The whole idea of that is there's no life suggested beyond that scene. You know, it's she's inscrutable. But I wanted that from Alan Alda or Ray Liotta. That, I mean, in a sense that, you know, they're...
They nailed it. Oh, God. When I see Reagan, I'm going to go, you know, Ray, with all the things you've done with guns and shovels and horrible things you've done to people in movies, you know, legendary movies, I go, but I think this is probably your most terrifying movie you've ever had. I mean, he reminded me so much of this, my first lawyer who I fired in my book, Bob Kaufman. I'm going to say his name. He terrified me. We go into a conference, and as I would recite my story, I'd say, well, then she did this. And he literally, I mean, you never saw a man seethe. He'd look at his two guys next to him and go, Jesus Christ. Like, everything I said was like another log on a fire
right.
of his battle scene. He was going to go and just cleave these people, you know. And I remember saying to myself, I don't think I could be around this guy too much. So I fired Ray and I hired Alan Alda.
You went the other way.
I went with the female Alan Alda. I went with the female. But the reason I say this to you is because, and this is something where, do you see, and maybe I'm projecting or I'm inlaying a lot of my own personal thing. Like, I've made films. I did this film, The Edge, with Tony Hopkins, and Lee Tamahori was the director. We had a David Mamet screenplay. I was so excited to go do this movie, and Tamahori was somebody who didn't understand, really, the psychologics of Mamet's writing. It was rather Baroque. It was very Mametian.
Right.
And whenever he'd come across something he didn't understand, he'd cut it. So he'd say, he was a Kiwi, I'll do my bad dialect here. He'd say, David does tend to go on a bit here, page 21. I thought, we cut these first four speeches. And I thought to myself, well, the way that David tends to go on in these speeches is the very reason I'm here.
Right.
Is to play the kind of weirdness. These guys are in like a weird zone. Everyone's taken something, maybe, and we're all weird. And
I like that movie.
Well, we did that movie, and he takes it and makes it 70% psychological thriller and 30% action-adventure film and flips it in the cutting room. But one moment was we're there, and again, this was really one of the most painful moments of my life, is I've got to sell Tony on the idea of what I think the scene's about, because he's not going to say it. He's turning to us going, men, what do you think is going on here? He wanted us to direct the scene. But the point is when I come to work with you, I want so, and maybe this is wrong, the nature of actors becoming so self-directing. I want to come in and I want you to tell me. I want you to tell me.
Right.
Do you think that that's wrong? You want the actors to tell you also
no,
what they feel?
No, I think that's what I would hope actors come in. It doesn't mean, though, that you're not going to have ideas, you know, but I think.
You hope they would.
You
want to decipher what you want to do.
Yes. Yeah. But I look at it as almost like creating sort of, not unlike we were saying about Rob Reiner, what we were saying about Kazan. It's like create a kind of structure around them, which is both in the dialogue and knowing your lines and like I said, having the lines down and, you know, blocking that's very specific. And then you don't have to worry about that stuff. You can be free within those parameters, and that it actually opens you up because you're not carrying, you're not trying to figure out how to make it work, that you're going with it. It doesn't mean, though, of course, if something doesn't work for an actor, you know, I wouldn't get up on this line. I'd want to stay, you know, that of course should be, I mean, I listen always to that because you have to believe it.
How much do you luxuriate in terms of composition and shooting, or do you defer very often to your cinematographer? How much of that's you and how much of that is them?
It is a collaboration. I mean, the way I generally do it is and if it's somebody I've worked with before, we might have a shorthand and, you know, sort of going into it, but we kind of take the script and I go through every scene together in prep.
Do you storyboard?
I do sometimes, but I'm such a bad drawer that it frustrates me. So I end up more shot listing and doing little drawings and, like, you know, things that look like football plays or things. But what I do is, in some ways, I describe how I picture the scene. And so I will give a kind of first pass on, maybe he gets up here, he goes over there, this is the, and then he'll respond Robbie Ryan in the case of Meyerowitz and Marriage Story. And he'll have his own take and say, but what if this? Or he'll say, that sounds right to me. And we'll kind of do a first pass going through the movie that way. But I will give my first sort of interpretation, visual interpretation of every scene. And then we'll do a second pass now with our notes of the whole movie and see if we still agree with what we did the first time, which also will accompany then having locations and knowing now what the locations are, and things can will always change or can change. Sometimes you find the location that matches your, you know, what was in your head, but often you find a location that gives you new ideas or and then I will have him in the rehearsal with me, often even shooting it on video. So that way, when we're working with the actors and just having the actors, that will also then. So it, usually by the time we're shooting, we've done at least three passes of the whole movie, a kind of visual storyboard.
Do you miss film?
I shot on film. I shot up through Greenberg, I'd shot everything on film. Then Francis, Mistress America, and While We're Young, I shot all digitally.
And Marriage Story?
Marriage Story is 35 millimeter.
Is it? Oh, yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. That's great. You have many pots on the stove. You know kind of other things you want to do, or does it come at you out of nowhere?
I would say up for the last, since from Squid to Marriage Story, I would say I've always had, there's always a thing in the queue that's just finding its way. You know, as I'm finishing a movie, I'm just starting to think about the next thing. And this is the first time I've got nothing. I'm depleted.
You're going out on a good note, though.
I'm depleted.
If you go out on Marriage Story, you've had a great career. I mean, come on, it's okay. You can be a messenger. It's
my
New Yorker.
It's my 10th movie. I think that's a good way.
10's a good round number. Just stop there. You're not doing it.
Or I'll just keep announcing my retirement and then unretiring.
But you don't have anything lined up.
But yeah, this cigarette is, I actually stubbed this one out and I didn't relight the other one. So I'm going to have to
rub two sticks together.
Yes, yes.
Figure it out.
Yeah.
Noah Baumbach. Whatever comes next, I'll be there. Marriage Story is in theaters and on Netflix. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.